Welcome to It Just So Happened. I am Richard Pulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 9th of August. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So where are we? Well, it's the city which Time Out magazine last year rated the best in the world. Yes, it's Edinburgh. We're performing today as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, the largest annual international arts festival in the world. And our venue this morning is the Hill Street Theatre, situated in Edinburgh's New Town. This historic A-listed building dates back to the 1820s. In 1893, it was purchased by the Masonic Lodge of Edinburgh, Mary's Chapel No. 1, so-called because the lodge first met within the old chapel of St. Mary's on Nidris Wynd in Edinburgh. It's designated number one on the roll of lodges of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, as it possesses the oldest existing minute of any Masonic lodge still operating, dating back to 1599, and the first historical reference of a Freemason being initiated as a member in 1634. This makes it likely to be the oldest Masonic lodge not only in Scotland, but in the whole world. The building has also been used as a fringe venue for the past 37 years, which makes it the oldest fringe venue constantly in operation. Fittingly, we have an audience with us today, as the Fringe welcomes audiences of up to 400,000 people each year. So we welcome about 1/100,000th of that number to this show. What's drawn in such huge numbers? Well, let me introduce today's panel. Please welcome Brian Ghosh, Mickey Gibbons and Angus Coutts. Brian Ghosh is both a stand-up comedian and software developer based in Edinburgh. He was in the Radio 4 Comedy Awards in 2019. Yes. I'd like to say hello.
Hello. No, there's nothing else to say about me. Okay, that's all of my characteristics.
Got everything. Sorry.
That is true.
Yeah. Mickey Gibbons is a doctor, occasional actor and comedy writer-performer. So he says he's familiar with dying and corpsing in equal measure. People are laughing at your joke. That's good.
Yeah.
Apparently, you live in East London with your husband and a family of semi-tame foxes, and are part of the sketch comedy group Forced Rhubarb.
With him.
With yeah. Brian.
So you do have another characteristic.
Oh, you're right. I didn't want to steal your thunder.
Thank you.
Okay, lovely. Thank you. And Angus Coutts, very briefly, stand-up comedian and Edinburgh tour guide.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. So straight over to you, Brian, please, for your On This Day picky.
Yeah. So, on this day, August 9th in 1173, construction began on the Leaning Tower of Pisa, or, as it was known at the time, the Tower of Pisa. Specifically, on the 9th of August, the foundations of the tower were laid. These are the very foundations that are defective and cause the distinctive lean. So August 9th is a poor anniversary for civil engineering, but a really good one for the Pisa Tourist Board. So it's actually just one of three parts of a larger complex. There's the Leaning Tower, the Wobbly Baptistry, and the Asbestos Cathedral. It was the last of the three to be constructed and is arguably the least grand. But obviously it's much more famous than the others entirely due to its defect. So construction began on this day, but it was done in three stages and took 199 years, a model being closely followed by HS2. The three stages specifically being careful planning, immediate fuck-up, and ploughing on regardless. So the foundations were laid, and they'd only built two floors when they noticed that it had started to lean. I mean, at this point, it really did stretch the definition of a tower. It was more the leaning cottage of Pisa. But seriously, to be only two stories high and already be at a noticeably jaunty angle, you know you've really messed up. So what was their solution? Well, it was quite easy. Wait for 100 years and see what happens. Turns out, still leaning, but let's crack on anyway. They continued to build the tower. I mean, that's incredible, because 100 years back then was like three generations later. So these people looked at this building, this already very old building, which had been stood there since before the time of their grandparents, and went, you know what that ominously leaning building needs to be? Significantly taller. Because they could have just knocked it down. You know, it was only two stories high. They could have just started again. But they were right not to, because obviously it's ended up as famous as it is. It's iconic. People love it. Even though, you know, you can't overlook that there's something fundamentally wrong at the base of it. You know, like the Cosby Show. So yeah, they cracked on. They didn't even try to write it. They built around the tilt, basically. They designed it so that every story had one side taller than the other one, so that the floors inside weren't too sloped. And that means that actually it's curved as it goes up, so that it's at the base it starts out at more of an angle, and then gradually gets more vertical as it goes towards the tip. It's often said that all towers are phallic. This one really seems to be two steps ahead of the competition. Anyway, so that's enough of that, but talking about geometry and penises, on this day in 1897, there was the first International Congress of Mathematicians. Because it was the vast majority of them were male. At this, the first International Congress of Mathematicians, only 4 out of 208 attendees were female. That's less than 2%. To put that into context, if the speculation about Joan the First is true, that's fewer women than have been Pope. Full disclosure: I did maths at university, and I've got to say there's something beautiful about, you know, this first international meeting of all these mathematicians, knowing that wherever in the world they come from, they all speak the same language. Loneliness. So yes, it was the first international meeting of mathematicians in 1897, and it wasn't a moment too soon, because obviously back then 1,897 was the highest number, and more were urgently needed, just so they could continue. You know, thank goodness they kept with the existing system, and their new suggestions of 12 and 11 splive never saw the light of day. And that's everything for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Well, I didn't expect Wednesday to be the show where it was all going to take a different turn. But there we go. So I've got a question for the panel as one of my little segue pieces here. So how did Thor help clean things up in the US at the beginning of the 20th century?
Thor.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the god Thor, or Thor Hushovd, the Norwegian cyclist?
Actually, neither. No.
Was
it
Heyerdahl?
It wasn't the person. It was the name for something to do with cleaning things up.
Is it an acronym?
No, I wish it was actually. Now you say that.
Is it short for something like Thorness? Let's leave that.
So Thor was the name of the first electrically powered clothes washer manufactured and sold in the US. It was invented in 1907, and the patent for the machine was issued on this day in 1910. The Chicago-based Hurley Electric Laundry Equipment Company mass-marketed Thor throughout the US from 1908 onwards, which makes you wonder why Wash Day didn't become a Thor's Day. I'm not as good as Brian. Although a company called 1900 Washing Machine Company of Binghamton, New York, claims to have produced the first electric washer in 1906, that wasn't mass marketed. The patent for Thor stated that a perforated cylinder is rotatably mounted within the tub containing the wash water. A series of blades lifted the clothes as the cylinder rotated. After 8 rotations in one direction, the machine would reverse rotation to prevent the cloths from wadding up into a compact mass. You can tell I've been having a fun fringe here researching this. The design also included a clutch, which allowed the machine to switch direction and an emergency stop rod.
So you could stall your washing machine.
Yeah. Oh, God. And do an emergency stop on it as well.
And did you need a license?
It's like machine signal manoeuvre or something. Yeah. However, it didn't have a high-speed spin cycle, and it still featured a clothes wringer. So it was kind of like a hybrid model in a sense. Oh, thank you. Someone laughed. I think it was a laugh. Either that or you just, I don't know. In the 1940s, Thor introduced the Automagic Hybrid Washer Dishwasher. So the top loading machine included both a removable clothes washing drum and a dishwashing drum. The Automagic was widely marketed. Question, why didn't it last long after its introduction?
Because nobody needed to wash plate armour anymore.
A plate armour. Yeah. That's too clever for this audience.
Were people sick of their plates tasting like their dirty clothes?
And did he deep vice versa?
Yeah.
And because it's a really dumb idea. I mean, it's, I can't be the only one thinking that. Usually, most of the time when I'm putting stuff in the washing machine, it's to get food off it.
Yeah. So basically, many consumers just didn't like the idea of washing dirty clothes and dishes in the same machine. Yeah. They just thought, yeah. And how many people in the world still hand wash their clothes now?
As of
2010?
Over a billion.
Probably half the population.
Yeah. So it's actually 5 billion as of 2010 out of a population of 7 billion. So I think we take these electric goods for granted, really. After that little diversion, it's over to you now, Mickey, for your On This Day piece. Thank you.
So we're also 121 years ago today was the coronation of Edward VII, or Bertie as he was usually known, son of Queen Victoria, notable tube line namesake and sponge pioneer, and of course famed genital adornment Prince Albert. Bertie was the longest-serving Prince of Wales at the time, the longest-serving heir to the throne, succeeding his mother, who was the longest-reigning British monarch up to that point, you know, a queen who defined an era, possessed of certain views that seemed a little quixotic at the time to his contemporaries, but now seemed perhaps a little ahead of their time. However, he was also notorious for his marital infidelities. Any similarities in any of that to any other recently crowned monarchs is, of course, coincidental. Although, interestingly, one of Bertie's mistresses, Alice Capel, was in fact the great-grandmother of... Sorry, a fluff. A great-grandmother of a woman who's now Queen Camilla, who was, of course, Charles's mistress. One of her other great-granddaughters, Judith Capel, went on to be the first millionaire contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So, which route to fame and fortune is preferable is really up to you, you know, tarrant or tyrant. The coronation didn't pass off entirely smoothly. For a start, it had to be delayed because the king had to have an abdominal abscess drained, which, to be fair, is a very good excuse. It doesn't, what's the word I'm looking for, attract further questioning. It just sounds very goopy. try it at work. No one wants the detail. And then in the ceremony itself, there were issues. So the Archbishop of Canterbury, Frederick Temple, was very old and frail, but having waited so long for Vicky to snuff it, he was buggered if he was going to let anyone else do any of the ceremonies. So he insisted on doing it all himself. He needed to be supported throughout by two bishops, which makes him sound rather like a vulnerable chess piece. And in a turn of events that would seem a bit heavy-handed, symbolism-wise, if it weren't actually true, the original crown proved to be too heavy a burden for the head of the convalescing king, so they changed to a lighter crown, of course, we all have crown options. So, you know, you don't know what mood's going to take you on the day, do you? The Archbishop, of course, managed to put that on backwards. Then when he knelt down to pay homage to the king, he couldn't get back up. He had to be helped up by the king and two bishops, which was a whole palaver, because the bishop could only move diagonally. He also needed his lines for the ceremony printed on giant cue cards due to his failing eyesight and weak memory, rather like he was presenting a late night talk show. which led to an unfortunate incident halfway through the sermon when he broke off talking about the Good Samaritan to take a sideways look at the news. Only compounded by him attempting to riff for 10 minutes on things you are unlikely to hear at a royal coronation. despite that, Bertie, you know, went on to a fairly successful reign. One thing, you know, we have the Edwardian era. Not all kings get to name an era, and you know, he only had 10 years on the throne. Victoria had 60 years to define the Victorian era, and you know, for context, the Mesozoic era was about 200 million years. But to be fair, on a day-to-day basis, absolutely fuck all happened. Bertie's credited with some with being instrumental in securing the alliance with France, it's known as the Entente Cordiale. He's very popular with the French public for his obvious appreciation for the three things closest to any French person's heart: the beauty of their language, the richness of their cooking, and the unparalleled expertise of their sex workers. Bertie was such a connoisseur of the latter that he had a special love seat, or siège d'amour, commissioned in a Paris brothel that allowed him to pleasure, or perhaps more accurately, be pleasured by, two ladies at once. It's worth a Google. You can find pictures of it online. See if you can figure out how. answers on a postcard, diagrams are advisable. Please show you're working. the closeness to the French unfortunately caused tensions. So he never had a very good relationship with his nephew, Kaiser Wilhelm. Their relationship can only be described as strained. Well, it can't only be described as strained. It can also be described as World War I. Something that he didn't quite live to see. He also invented leaving the bottom button of your waistcoat undone, as modelled by myself today. I say invented, he was just quite large, and so it was more comfortable. It's very much like me saying, I invented the current stains on your tie. I mean, stretch is the definition of invention, it's not exactly the printing press. Still, it's something. I need to move on to another page. He's also credited with popularising the Sunday roast, which may have contributed to the necessity for the waistcoat invention. And on balance, given the dreadful selection of crusaders, serial wife beheaders, and one outright Nazi we have to choose from, I say if we have to have a king, the surprisingly anti-racist Sunday roast inventing guy gets my vote. The only caveats there being that we don't have to have a king, and you don't get a vote.
Thank you. Thank you, Ricky. My second segue piece here. By what name is Harry Roger Webb better known?
Cliff. Did he know?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
It's Elton John.
Could have been, but we've established it. It's Sir Cliff Richard. And do we know where he was born?
I think it's India.
It was. Yes. Yeah, look now in British India.
No. This is helping me.
I'm keeping my eye on you now. He holds dual citizenship, so one is British. Do you know what the other one is?
I don't think it was in. That would be too easy a question.
No, it's not. It's not easy, actually. You either know or you don't. So it's actually Barbados is the other one.
Sure, that makes sense. Him and Rihanna.
So it's on this day in 1958 that he signed a record deal with EMI Records, aged just 17. Cliff Richard's 1958 hit "Move It" is widely regarded as the first authentic British rock and roll record, and laid the foundations for the Beatles and Merseybeat music. John Lennon reportedly said of Richard that before Cliff and the Shadows, there had been nothing worth listening to in British music. His successful performing and recording career in the UK has extended over 6 decades, whether you like it or not. What was his backing group, the Shadows, originally called? And why did they change their name?
I literally know one thing about the Shadows, and that's Hank Marvin.
And Apache.
Oh, yeah, of course. Great song. Yeah. Like, he's brilliant, by the way. As much as people make fun of Cliff Richard, Hank Marvin's one of the greatest guitarists of all time. Mm-hmm. He plays a red Stratocaster.
Sure. And they do that little dance where they step forward and go sideways and back.
Yeah.
It's the only dance my dad knows. In some ways, it's the basis for all dance.
It's the sort of dance I know after a few drinks as well. But, anyway, so the backing group was known as the Drifters.
Oh.
And they changed name because of potential litigation over sharing the same name as another group. Yeah. Now, how many records do you think Cliff Richard has sold in the UK and worldwide?
More than 20.
It is more than 20.
Fewer than 7 billion.
Fewer than 7 billion? It is that as
now,
well.
Brian,
so
you,
you, you go for the mathematician here can go for the average.
Halfway between them. Okay. 3,500,000,000.
Well, in the UK, he sold 21.5 million singles and worldwide 250 million records. So he's the third top-selling artist in the UK singles chart history behind
Elvis and the Beatles.
Elvis and the Beatles.
Where's Madonna on that list?
I don't know. Right. I only know the top three. That's all I need to know for this section.
The rest are losers.
Yes, yes. How many number one singles and top ten singles has he had in the UK?
I remember.
More than 20.
Yeah.
Fewer than 10.
I think it might be less than 20, but I know there was a thing that he had a number one single in every decade from the 50s until the 2010s when he didn't. So I think we're looking at about 9 or 10.
Yeah, yeah, he's had 14 singles get to number one, of which four were UK Christmas number ones. And he's had 67 UK top 10 singles, which is quite impressive. The second highest total for any artist behind Elvis. And how many of his singles, albums and EPs have reached the UK top 20?
67 singles. Well, we can work this out. Do the
maths. I've just got numbers floating in front of me like a beautiful mind, but...
You don't need to spend too long on it.
Three.
Yeah.
I think it's 11 Tish Blythe.
Could be, couldn't it?
112.
Oh, not bad. 130. Oh. 130, which is quite a lot, isn't it?
That's
it. So,
I was actually closer.
Yes. So he does hold the record with Presley as the only act to make the UK singles charts in all of its first six decades from the 1950s. And final stats question, how many Brit Awards has he won?
None.
One.
Two.
It's actually three.
Ah,
yeah.
If only we had one more person on the panel.
Best British male solo artist in 1977 and in 1982, and he got a Lifetime Achievement Award in 1989, which is quite a long time ago.
Actually, it's not that long ago. I was two, so I'm very young.
Yes,
so.
Yes. Author and rock music critic Tony Parsons said, if you don't like at least some Cliff Richard, then you don't like pop music. Among his many awards, some of the more offbeat ones include the National Viewers and Listeners Association Award for Outstanding Contribution to Religious Broadcasting and Light Entertainment.
That's Mary Whitehouse's lot, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't in 1970, yeah, it was quite a long time ago, that one. And also won TV Times Most Exciting Male Singer on TV in 1980. That's how exciting TV was back then. Do you know who some of the ladies of whom he has dated over the years? I don't know why it came out in that way.
I feel like any joke I could make here would be libelous. Or slanderous. What's a podcast? Is that libel or slander? Anyway, let's move on.
It's not going to be slander.
Thank you.
Madonna, sure.
Well, so he dated Australian dancer Delia Wicks, actress Una Stubbs, dancer Jackie Irving, and tennis player Sue Barker, most famously.
I've literally heard of one of those people.
Oh, okay, that's fine. In August 2014, Richard was one of 200 public figures who were signatories to a letter to The Guardian expressing their hope that Scotland would vote to remain part of the United Kingdom in September's referendum on that issue of that year. So there we go. Don't we all love him? And now over to Angus for your On This Day piece. Thank you.
Right, so I'm going to give a little bit of a disclaimer first, right, okay? I'm not like these guys. You can tell I'm not like these guys, right? I never went to university. I didn't do any research for this. I was out drinking last night. It's been fun. It's okay. Well, you guys did great there. My thing that happened on this day, now this is a thing that genuinely did happen. I was trying to write jokes about it. Turns out there's not much you can write about. But we'll get into it anyway, right? Look, you can probably tell just by looking at me. I'm a man that likes eating chips and drinking beer, right? Carry a little bit of weight, but I want to talk about a different fat man. Because it was on this day in 1945 that Nagasaki was decimated by the United States of America when they dropped an atomic bomb to end the Second World War. And I was like writing, trying to find something that was going to be really funny about atomic war. Turns out it's not that cheery or jolly a subject, to be honest. So instead I started looking at Japan, okay? okay? And Japan is home to one of my favourite companies in the world. They're called Nintendo. Now, they've got nothing, that's my honest day done, by the way, okay? That's what happened. I want to talk about Mario for a minute, and Jenny, it's going to be a minute. You think these guys did actual research. I've got one real cool fact about Mario that I'm going to tell you guys, and you're all going to be absolutely delighted that I've told you, okay? But at the end of it first, Mario's important to me because he's a little, short, chubby guy that gets the girl in the end. And I think that's a thing that people like me should aspire to, you know? I learned all my Italian from Mario. I literally only know how to introduce myself. It's-a-me, Angus. everyone going somewhere, let's-a-go. But my favourite fact about it, and this is genuinely all I'm going to tell you guys, and then Richard can do a History of Edinburgh thing, is that, you know that it's-a-me bit? We hear that as like, quite a pastiche of Italians and the way they speak. It's-a-me, Mario. It's me, Mario. It's Super Mario. It's-u-me is Japanese for, like, great, good, super. Mm. Essentially at the start of every game, he's saying Super Mario. He's saying his own name in Japanese. Oh. Is that not cool as fuck? That's a fact for you. Anyway, yeah, Nagasaki got bombed. And Nintendo survived. Nintendo was there before. Nintendo's there after. Nintendo is there forever. But that's it.
Grazie. Grazie. So now we come to the second.
That's not in Mario.
So no. Sorry. Right. So we come to the second half of the show, which is uncovering some of the history of Edinburgh. Now, allegedly, Edinburgh is built on seven hills, but it's not actually a particularly unique thing. There are many cities in the world, too long to list, that claim to be built on seven hills. But can you name any of the others?
Sheffield.
Yes, that's not come up yet.
Rome, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Lisbon
as well.
London sometimes claims.
Does it?
Yeah. People want to be like Rome, you know. seven hills. I mean, if you go around pointing at things, you can find seven tall things. You go, sure. Yeah.
I think another one might be Plovdiv in Bulgaria.
Oh, right.
Which
okay.
was
quite possibly
Philippopolis that centred the Roman Empire in. Mm. I've forgotten what they called that area of their empire, but anyway, that was essentially. I don't think it was.
No.
That's a car, isn't it?
That's a car, yeah.
That you'll find. But anyway. Athens, yes, that's a good one as well. Other cities include Jerusalem, Tehran, Prague, Kyiv, and in America, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and in Ohio, somewhere called Seven Hills. Let's test your Edinburgh knowledge. Can you name Edinburgh's Seven Hills?
Yes.
No.
Arthur's Seat, the one the castle's on.
That's
why. Thank you. Blackford, Corstorphine. Is Carlton Hill. Is the Crags going to count as another hill?
Nope.
No. Okay, so I'm needing two more.
Yeah, you are.
Sorry?
Braids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What are we going for so far? You said Christopher,
right?
Yeah. Come on, audience.
You two are from Edinburgh.
It's another C one.
I got the jolly right.
All right, fair enough.
Craig. Craig Locker.
Locker, of course. Where the Andy Money Tennis Centre is.
Arthur's Seat is a hill just to the east of Edinburgh city centre, 822 feet above sea level, which is in fact an ancient volcanic plug. The lava has been dated to about 340 million years old. How did Arthur's Seat get its name?
Oh, well, we're actually mispronouncing it. It's pronounced Arthur's Seat for sponsorship reasons.
Can you drive up there? Then.
Twinned with Dacia, of
course. Yes.
Yes.
I just one of my favourite things to tell people as a tour guide in Edinburgh. We don't know. We're not 100% sure. There's a bunch of things around it. One being that people like to put about, a lot of tour guides like to say this, is that it's King Arthur. It's something to do with him, and he was actually from here in Camelot. Of course, we all know it was kind of down Wales kind of way, but no one cares about that. And then when he died, he was buried in a secret chamber on Arthur's Seat, and that's the name we get. It's probably not true, but there's certainly no evidence of a burial chamber there. We kind of know roughly who King Arthur was as well, so we would know he was brought back here. My favourite legend, the one I actually choose to believe, is that there was a three-headed giant called Arthur, who sat on it quite a lot, and he terrorised the people of Edinburgh until one wee boy had enough. Killed the giant, and that's where it gets the name. That's the one I choose to believe. You can choose your own, whatever you like, though. Whatever you like. Have you ever read the TripAdvisor reviews for Arthur's Seat?
Oh, go on.
They're absolutely brilliant. There's one star where this woman, she's clearly American. I walked up this hill, there wasn't a cafe at the top, there was no bathroom, I sat down on the grass, it was wet and I looked like I'd soiled myself, 1 star. Walked up a hill, good for you.
Which is obviously the hill's fault.
Yeah.
So we've got Arthur's Seat and then underneath the area known as Salisbury Crags, and that was formed by a glacier that went past in the last 2 million years and revealed the crags, as it were. How did the local geology inform the so-called father of modern geology, James Hutton?
We're not talking about the vestiges of natural creation. That was published here, wasn't it?
It was a speech to the Royal Society, the Vestiges of the Honorary Prospect of an End. Love that guy. My favourite figure. Yeah, love him.
Is he uniformitarianism, or are we talking about, versus catastrophism? Why do I know these things?
That's it. I love him because he was an old pervert.
What is it about this show? I don't know.
It's just what I'm here.
No, I don't think so. It's not just you.
I think they refer to his perversion as Hutton's unconformity.
Yes.
That's a good geology joke for any of you. Geologists who are here!
Is it because you can see the strata of the rocks because of the way that it was eroded away? You can see where it's formed over time.
Yeah, so there's a particular section called area called Hutton's section where you can actually see this and where he observed this and could infer that the Earth's actually constantly in motion over a very long period of time, and therefore the Earth wasn't only 6,000 years old, which is what a lot of religious people were saying at the time. How is Edinburgh's National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars better known? And where is it?
I'm assuming you know this one, Angus.
I sure do.
I thought you were just being polite and giving me and Mickey a crack at it.
I am.
All right, then. It's just outside, isn't it? I walked past on my way here.
It is outside.
Is it?
Yes, it's not outside.
But it's not quite.
We're not inside here.
Yeah, everything that's not inside here is outside here, to be fair, but it's not like the Statue of Liberty, which is technically also outside here as well.
Yeah.
Just topologically speaking, you're completely
just
on
just slightly further away, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about it then?
It's up one of the hills. It's up Colwyn Hill. It's a big thing, looks like a half-finished Parthenon.
Oh, the National Monument.
The National Monument as well,
so that's what it's better known as then.
Well, it has a moniker, if that's the right word. So it's known as Edinburgh's Disgrace. And so what
I thought that was Angus in the pub last Saturday.
That's a more modern version.
I was going to say that's my mum's thing.
Why is it known as Edinburgh's Disgrace? Do you know anything about it now that you know what we're talking about?
There's a clue in what I said, though. Like a half-finished...
That it's your mum?
It's my mum,
Did they run out of money?
They sure did. Yeah. They didn't finish it.
Yeah.
A memorial to dead soldiers. And we're like, yeah. No money.
Well, there'll always be more.
There will be.
Come on, I mean. Bleak but true.
So Parliament put up some money, but then the rest had to be raised by public subscription, and £42,000 needed to be raised. So they started work with only a third of the money raised in 1822, and then they stopped when they just ran out of money. And so it became known as Edinburgh's Disgrace because it was a half-finished building.
Actually, I was listening to a historian of monuments and sculptures the other day talking about, not quite this, but she was saying, whenever it says by public subscription, it's not true. It never happened. It was always a couple of weird rich guys, but they liked to put on it by public subscription. But it was never, you know, the widows and orphans giving their little bit. It was always just a couple of rich guys like, yeah, so you have a statue.
And the rich guys didn't want their name attached to the...
No, well, I mean, probably by the time they were halfway through, they're into, Crimean War or something, and they're like, well, better get on with this one now.
This particular building was designed on the Parthenon in Athens, so why that choice?
They just really liked pillars.
Mm. Mm.
Did, I mean, neoclassical design's all about pillars, man. Yeah. Mm.
So it's during the time of the Gothic Enlightenment, so these sort of things were very popular at the time, and Edinburgh was known as the Athens of the North. The leading man behind the campaign to have this monument based on the Parthenon as a design was Thomas Bruce, 7th Earl of Elgin. Do we know anything about him? Oh, we're getting a loo from the audience, yeah.
Marble dude.
Yeah, the marble dude, yes.
Again, something that runs slightly in the family, much like the Keppels and adultery, that he... he's known for taking the marbles off the path, and I believe it was his grandson who burned the Summer Palace in Beijing, which was, you know, this great complex of art and all that, as a punishment expedition against the Chinese for some reason or other.
Take all their tea.
Yeah, and they weren't taking our opium and that sort of thing. Yeah. Which is weird, because I find people really like opium. My work is an option.
Well, that a little bit.
Tend not to say no. Yeah.
So you've got this half-completed monument, which was abandoned in the early 1800s. In the years since, at various stages, people have thought, oh, maybe we could complete the monument and make it into something. Any ideas what people might have thought would be a good thing to make of this?
Roller derby?
A roller
derby. I mean, I don't know if Edinburgh has one already, but
should
if not...
Two teams.
Two teams?
Yeah, man.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Student accommodation?
Yeah.
A fringe venue.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if it hasn't been used as that already at some point.
It may well have been. So someone was saying yesterday in the show that the statue to Greyfriars Bobby was a venue.
I think it might have been Martin's one once. Yeah. I don't know if it is now. Or maybe it's the park they'll use it as their meeting point.
Yes, yes.
When the book is out.
Anyway, slightly off the track here. So it was proposed to make it a monument to Queen Victoria when she died in 1901. Something to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the 1707 Act of Union with England.
Yeah.
Don't know why that wasn't popular. A new Scottish National Gallery in 1907. A Scottish Parliament building in 1908. And a memorial to those who fell in the Great War in 1918. So also, Glasgow Council offered to help out. So they said, yeah, we will help you complete this building with one proviso. What do you think that might have been?
It's moved to Glasgow.
Yes, that sounds likely, doesn't it? Anything else?
There has to be a little Billy Connolly there saying, do you know Glasgow's better than Edinburgh, you know? Every 5 minutes.
It just says visit Glasgow in Latin on the top.
Almost, yeah. Glasgow Council said, yeah, we'll help you complete it as long as we can have our crest for Glasgow showing on the monument. Edinburgh declined, politely, I think. Hence one of the other names for the monument, which is the Pride and the Poverty. However, where was a full-scale replica of the Parthenon actually successfully built and completed in 1897? Yeah, that famous monument in Hull.
The second Athens of the North.
You either know it or you don't, but it's in the US.
Is it Athens, Georgia?
Oh,
that's a good guess.
I like the guess. Unfortunately not. It's actually Nashville, Tennessee, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the state. So it is possible to build a Parthenon if you know what you're doing. Right, very long question this, so please concentrate. What happened in 1916 which made the Keeper of the Great Seal of Scotland move the regalia of Scotland from the Crown Room in Edinburgh Castle to one of the castle vaults?
Moths.
Moths.
Moths. You get moths, you need to move your clothes. This is normal. Or did the seal get loose and got them wet? You know, the seal.
Yeah. We're all applauding.
Yeah,
right.
Something to do with the war.
Yeah,
it's just a random whim. Just they like moving stuff, don't they?
Okay.
Was it the air raid?
It was the air raid.
Yeah, 10 points.
If we had points, we'd give them. German air raids on the city, in which one bomb exploded near the castle. So it was decided that the roof of the Crown Room was not bomb-proof, so the regalia were moved for their safety. But what was novel about these particular air raids in 1916?
Zeppelins?
Zeppelins, indeed, yes.
They were the first, weren't
they? Yep. For about half an hour on the night of 2nd to the 3rd of April 1916, two German airships, the L-14 and L-22, dropped 7 incendiary and 17 high-explosive bombs on Leith and the city of Edinburgh. 13 people died and 24 were injured. The White Hart Hotel in the Grassmarket and the County Hotel in Lothian Road suffered substantial damage, as well as a number of tenement buildings in Newington. There's a flagstone in the Grassmarket which marks the spot where a bomb landed in front of the White Hart Inn, making a 9 by 6 foot crater. Talking of the White Hart Inn, It claims to be the oldest pub in the centre of Edinburgh, as you corrected me the other day, dating back to 1516, and also claims to be the most haunted. But how do you measure these things?
To be fair, it is the most haunted pub.
It is.
Which is a title it shares, along with least haunted, with every pub, because none of them are haunted.
Right, okay.
So. Unless, of course, you use definition of haunted and just regularly visited.
In which case,
I don't even
There's
know.
No way the White Hart in the Grass Market is the most regular.
It's probably the most haunted pub in Edinburgh. It's probably just like that Skanky Spoons by the station.
Yeah.
Some very haunted looking people in there. Yeah. Who stayed at the White Hart Inn during his last visit to Edinburgh in 1791 and there bid farewell to his lover, Agnes Nancy McAlose, before she left for Jamaica?
Cliff Richard. Halfway through that question, like, look.
He goes back a long way. Yes.
That's borderline libelous.
He was cleared.
Of course, then he was Harry Webb. It wasn't. Yeah. So, 1791. A poet.
Oh, Scott. Burns.
It was Burns. Yes. Nancy, who left for Jamaica, was the inspiration for which of Burns's poems?
Ode to a Haggis.
So I like bringing this over to him. That's a much funnier answer than I was going to say, but I like educating people about Burns. He was a dirty old man. He wrote a wee poem, a song, which I believe, I don't think it was this one that was about her, but it might have been. It was called, and this is true, look it up, you'll enjoy it, called Nine Inch Will Please a Lady. It's about exactly what it sounds like.
Yes, the Tower of Pisa.
He was a real rascal.
Well, the answer I was looking for was Aphon Kiss, and he sent her a copy of the manuscript after their final meeting. Now, in 1803, William and Dorothy Wordsworth stayed at the White Hart while on their tour of Scotland, and Dorothy left the equivalent of a very early TripAdvisor comment describing the pub. Now, bearing in mind that this is in the Grass Market, how do you think Dorothy described the White Hart Inn and her stay there?
The grass.
Sorry?
Good grass.
Good grass in the Grass Market.
She was a famous stoner, Dorothy.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that.
I sat on the grass and it looked like I'd soiled myself.
So she described it as not noisy and tolerably cheap. How times have changed.
Yeah.
Right, next question. Who is Greyfriars Bobby? Yeah, so I was talking about earlier.
He's a fringe venue.
A fringe venue, yes.
Dog, it definitely existed.
Now, what brand of dog?
Brand?
Well, what flavour? What flavour?
Thor!
What flavour of dog?
I don't know much about dogs.
Right.
What kind of dog?
What do you
A Spaniel wasn't a Spaniel, though.
People think it was a Scottie dog. All the time it was called a Scottish dog. No, he is a Scottish dog, though. It's a Skye Terrier.
Yeah, Skye Terrier. Has to be very careful about this. So born.
That's a weird name, because Terrier means grand, Skye means sky. So just put that out there.
Somewhere hovering in between.
Yeah, it's sort of.
A floating dog.
Yeah.
More clever than it is funny, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's my brand. That's the brand of dog I am.
So Bobby was born on 4th of May 1855. He became known for spending 14 years guarding the grave of his owner in the kirkyard until he himself died in January 1872. Bobby's headstone was placed by the Dog Aid Society at the kirkyard's entrance in 1981. What spot does this mark?
The spot where he would sit.
Well, that's what many tourists think, but actually no one quite knows where the grave was, and it doesn't mark any particular spot. But tourists see that and think, oh, that's where the dog must have been.
If you ever come on my walking tour, I will absolutely lie to you and say that's where the dog is buried.
Who owned Bobby?
Originally?
Cliff Richard. No.
You can't keep saying Cliff Richard to everything. Yeah.
John Gray?
Yes. So do we know anything about John Gray?
There's a bunch of different things about him.
Yeah, it's unclear, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, was he a night watchman? Was he a farmer?
Night watchman's what I say. Disney, when they made the movie, they called him a farmer, which I think they might have made up.
Right.
I think that might be
yeah.
a Disney invention.
Yeah. Now, in 19th century Europe, there are over 60 documented accounts of graveyard or cemetery stray dogs who were fed by visitors and curators, to the point that the dogs made the graveyards their home. And then people would begin to believe that they were waiting by a grave, and so the dog was looked after. And this is what happened in the kirkyard at Greyfriars in Edinburgh. Visitor numbers gradually increased, and then the locals, being canny, realised, well, here's something we can make a bit of money out of. So they encouraged this to happen. And it's thought that Bobby actually died in 1867 and the dog was simply replaced by another dog just so they could keep this scam going, which explains why he lived for 14 years. The 1912 novel, Greyfriars Bobby, by the American author Eleanor Atkinson, popularised the story in the United States, and her version of the story is the one which is the most familiar to people today. Why might this be surprising or not surprising?
It was published in a book. That's not that's going to have more reach, isn't it?
Yeah. But
she'd never been here.
Yeah, she'd never.
Is that right?
She'd never set foot in Scotland, and she just made up most of the story based on their own thoughts and imagination. But that's the story. Is that the one that includes the farmer then?
I don't know. I've never heard of her other book before. Yeah. That's kind of like the Outlander books. A woman who wrote Outlander. She'd never been to Scotland when she wrote the first book.
Mm. John Denver had never been to West Virginia when he wrote Take Me Home, Country Roads. Put it out there.
Cliff Richard had never been
I was waiting for Cliff Richard. And is he not teetotally? He's never had mistletoe and wine.
Yeah,
anyway,
he strikes me as a teetotal type.
Anyway.
And Robert Burns didn't have no inches.
Did he ever see that? Anyway, so how did the English philanthropist Lady Burdett Coutts choose to commemorate Bobby after he died?
Chirping to bank.
What's that?
Chirping to bank.
I still didn't hear that.
Chirping to bank.
Oh,
Coutts.
Very topical.
Did she build the statue? Was it her that did the statue?
So she commissioned the drinking fountain. That's the one you can see on the George IV Bridge in Candlemaker Row. The statue with the shiny nose of the dog. So the drinking fountain would have an upper fountain for humans and a lower fountain for dogs,
yeah.
And Bobby's statue on the top. And it was erected the year after Bobby's death in 1873. What is unusual about this monument stroke building, other than being a fringe venue, as I've been told.
Because that one kind of looks like, is that the wrong breed of dog?
Oh, I'll come to that in a moment. Yeah.
My question is this, now this may be dumb. How do the dogs operate the fountain, the lower fountain? Or is it assumed that they're escorted? You know what I mean?
I feel like
the lower part
yeah.
is just like, would you just be filled with water?
It's like
yeah.
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 And I guess it would just...
I mean, we've never seen it work, because it doesn't work. Is that what you mean, it doesn't work?
To come to that, Edinburgh Council shut off all the drinking fountains in the city in around 1975 due to health scares, so that's why people don't really see it as a fountain.
So people ask about when the public toilets are going to reopen, because they shut them in COVID and they haven't reopened them since. They're never going to reopen them, because they're never switching on the drinking fountains again.
Yeah. But, so do you know the answer to...
I don't think I do, no.
Oh, right, okay, so it's Edinburgh's smallest listed building.
I believe it's Scotland's smallest Grade A listed building.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's not really a building though, is it? But it's like, it must be another word for it.
Yeah,
like
it'll be a
building or monument.
It's listed, yeah.
But it's the smallest anyway. Other things that have happened to it, in 1984 it was hit by a car, so it had to be restored and reinstated the following year. And in 2006 there was a film made called The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby. And why was this controversial? I've already hinted at this.
He used the wrong flavour.
And also, frankly, the one thing that we know about this story about Greyfriars Bobby is he literally didn't go on any adventures. He stayed in the
It's not much of a hero's journey, is it? Yeah.
So the part of Bobby in the film was given to a West Highland White Terrier.
I know.
Which led to protests from the Skye Terrier Breed Club.
Will Hollywood ever stop whitewashing films?
We're lucky it wasn't Scarlett Johansson.
Probably was.
Christopher Figg, the producer, said that a Westie was used because its white coat would stand out in the dark and because its eyes would not be hidden from the camera by a fringe. So you had to justify it. Now, I did have a question here, which is, what sign is at the kirkyard's entrance near to the dog's headstone? but I've since found out myself that it's not actually there. So
it's another myth that tour guides like to tell people.
Yeah.
There was a sign that said no dog fouling, and that led to us telling lies. There used to be a sign that said no dogs allowed in the graveyard, but there never was a sign that said no dogs. And I assume that's what you're going for.
I fell for it, yeah. I fell for it. So you can't believe everything you read on the internet. Who would have thought?
Or here today.
Yes, it's a whole new thing.
It's not a bizarre precaution for a place that is full of buried bones to keep dogs. I mean, it would be understandable.
And graveyards have been going for so long. Occasionally, again, this is a true fact. This is one of the lying tour guide facts. Occasionally, bones in the graveyard, in graveyards, they're real close to the top there.
I'm going to move on to a thing I've not covered in the show, but yet. What did two teenage boys do in 2003, which resulted in them being charged with violating sepulchres?
I love this story, but I'm going to give you guys a chance to guess it first.
Charged with what?
Violating sepulchres, which I assume is a very old law, which didn't need to be used.
Oh, sorry, I thought that might be a name of a person.
I mean, I don't know, again, I'm scared on the edge of libel here. I don't want to think about what they're doing, but I mean, is it sexual, is it drugs, I mean, what is it?
It's neither of those things.
Go on, tell
us. Okay, remind you of the guy, come on now.
Yeah. Go on, tell us, Angus.
A guy called George Mackenzie, who was a lawyer in the late 17th century. He was a pretty bad dude. He oversaw the first kind of concentration camp at the southwest corner of Greyfriars, the Covenanters' prison. And he's got a nice big domed mausoleum in Greyfriars. It's called Mackenzie Mausoleum. He's also known as Bloody Mackenzie. He wasn't a great guy. In some respect, we've not got time to tell you about why he was alright as well. But in 2003, some people broke in to his mausoleum. And the rumour is, they broke in and they were playing with a skull. Like, I mean, football. Like, kicking it about is what I heard. But certainly, that's the tomb that they broke into.
And so was sepulchres, like, some sort of law in football?
Yeah, they commit a foul, was a red card, and no one was sent off, so the law had to get involved. Mm.
But at least they weren't dog, because no dog fouling.
That's it.
So the many other famous people buried in Greyfriars Kirkyard, who was William McGonagall?
Oh, arguably the worst poet of all time.
Or the best.
It gets worse and worse, yeah. So
there are lots of others who are awful.
I don't know, I would say that I'm pretty shoddy at poetry.
If you've read the Tate Bridge disaster, it is hard to. Let's say he's the worst. He's the worst poet in the pre-Ryan Giggs era.
Oh my god! I read that entire poem on stage last year because that case happened during the Fringe, and it's horrifying. If you've not read it, look up Ryan Giggs' poem. Later on, it's a dirty poem he sent to his mistress.
Well, steering clear of that then, William McGonagall was an Irish-born Scottish weaver, actor, and extremely bad poet, I got here, but people seem to conflate this now to him being the worst poet ever, but that'd be quite hard. So he moved to Edinburgh in 1895. His only apparent understanding of poetry was his belief that it needed to rhyme. So here is the beginning and the end of his poem, The Tay Bridge Disaster. I'll try and give it my best here. Beautiful railway bridge of the silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. It's not too bad, is it?
It's terrible. It's also inaccurate.
Well,
78 people died, not 90.
Well, I've got 75. Yeah,
oh, 75.
So it's going down. Yeah, he says 90, but yeah, it's shite and inaccurate.
Yeah.
And he finished with, I must now conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly, without the least dismay, that your central girders would not have given way, at least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side with buttresses, at least many sensible men confesses. For the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed.
This is the sort of contemporary equivalent of jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams, isn't it?
No, I think that what that tells us, I think it's the clearest example that William McGonagall was a very autistic man. And he was really into engineering, and he was like, I'm going to write this poem about the disaster, because everyone cares when these people died, but I'm going to get all my stuff about buttresses in there, because I love buttresses, so I do. Yeah.
He loved big buttresses, Andy couldn't
no, My favourite McGonagall poem is only three lines long, which is actually really rare for him. It's called On Yonder Hill, and it goes, On yonder hill there stood a coo, it's no there new, it must have shifted.
I like that. Yeah. On one occasion, his workmates paid a local theatre owner to allow McGonagall to appear in the title role in a production of Macbeth. How did the play go wrong in the final act?
I think I might know this. Hmm. I think didn't he refuse to die?
Yes.
Yeah, because people wanted to see him, so he just kept going.
Well, he was convinced that the actor playing Macduff was jealous of him. So he refused to die.
It's proper, like in-depth character stuff there.
Yeah. He's putting my little bugbear about Macbeth, which is that it's definitely pronounced Macbeth. Because it rhymes with Heath like 10 times during the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shakespeare didn't really write in Gaelic, though, to be fair, so I don't know whether I take his things. You know. It's a Gaelic name, Macbeth, means son of life. He was a real king, 17 years on the throne. Only Scottish monarch travelled and visited the Pope. My favourite king as well.
Oh.
Hmm. If you can have a favourite king. Honestly, I think the French had the right idea in the late
1700s. Now I feel like I need to declare my favourite king.
Yeah, who's your favourite king?
Elvis. Right, okay.
So the final thing on McGonagall is that he died above what is now the Captain's Bar in Edinburgh's South College Street, penniless for some reason, in 1902. And our time has run away with us, I'm afraid. So it just leaves me now to thank all the guests that you've seen today. So we saw and heard Brian Ghosh, Mickey Gibbons and Angus Coutts. And I would like to thank the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Hill Street Theatre for hosting us today. There's another show here tomorrow at 10:45 with a different panel and different On This Day topics, naturally, because it will be the 10th of August. I'm keeping up. And guests, would you very quickly, like 30 seconds, like to plug anything you're doing in the Fringe or out with the Fringe?
So next week I've got a show with my friend Callum Aspen, so it's called Brian Ghosh and Callum Aspen Who? That runs from Tuesday 15th to Sunday 20th, so if anyone happens to be around, it would be great to see that.
This is the Brian brought one flyer.
Mickey brought the one flyer.
I'm struggling to remember your name. I'm not doing a show at Fringe, I'm only popping up briefly, but Brian and I we do sketch comedies together and getting a bunch of actors together, so keep an eye out for Forced Rhubarb. We'll be putting some stuff out as a podcast pretty soon.
I have a show today, 2:45. You should come see me. It's at Stand 4. Tickets are available. extremely available. It's a 2:45, it's a 45-minute show. My mum and dad are coming today. I'm going to say some sexually aggressive things in front of my mum. So, you know, if you want to come and catch that awkwardness, it's called Short King 2:45. We've got flyers. I keep saying 2:45 because I'm an idiot. And I did not put the time on my flyers. So it's the key information people need. I also have a whiskey-based podcast you listen to. It's called The Sipping Point. We've got some episodes out already. A new episode out today with an amazing Irish comedian, Ryan Cullen. It's just dropped today. But yeah, have a listen to that. I'll give out some stuff outside, so don't worry about that.
Thank you very much. And I'd just like to plug my own other show, which is called Richard Paulson's Short Joke Teller. It's a clean show. And it's one-liners and puns, if you like that kind of thing. And it's on at 12:45 every day at the Beehive Inn until the 27th, 16th accepted. And I've got some flyers if you'd like to take one as you leave. That'd be wonderful. Shall I do a final On This Day piece, or are we kind of run out of time? It's just a nod to the writer David Nobbs, who died on this day in 2015. He was the author of three novels about the fictional everyman Reginald Perrin, who suffers a midlife crisis and tries to escape his dreary existence. The stories inspired three hit TV series in the 1970s. So I was going to leave you with a few quotes. If you don't know anything about the series, it probably won't mean much to you. First of all, Reggie's boss CJ. I didn't get where I am today without recognising a rib-tickling play on words when I hear one. So there you go. The early bird catches a cold. If at first you don't succeed, you'll catch the early worm. The only good ringer's a dead ringer. Every silver lining has a cloud. Then as Reggie explains yet again while he's late arriving at work, 22 minutes later, Scape Puma, Chessington North. And my marriage is like an aircraft's black box. It's mysterious but completely indestructible. And two philosophical thoughts to end on. Number one, that's the trouble with living for the moment. It buggers up the next moment. And number two, never outstay your doodah. So on that note, it's goodbye.